Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
The idea of regime change being affected from the air, it's got no precedent. Netanyahu and Trump's theory that Iranians will see the weakness of the regime and rush to replace it, I'm skeptical of all of that. I really am.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police arrived at the Palasik's home after the intrusion, there was barely a clean surface in the house. It had been torn apart, and forensic teams spent days trying to listen to what it was telling them. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Just a warning, there will be some graphic descriptions in this episode. This is episode 3 of the case of the two intruders.
Irma Palasik's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
For the last week, the court in Canberra has heard just how hard police search for clues that might tell them who was behind the violent home invasion that left Irma Palasik dead in 1999, almost as long as the search through the house itself lasted. And there, through it all, has been Elizabeth Byrne, ABC court reporter in Canberra. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Stocky.
And as well as Elizabeth, we're very lucky to have ACT investigative reporter James Viver joining us for this episode as well. G'day, James.
Hi, Stocky.
Liz, before we dive into this episode, there's so much to unpack with this crime scene. Can you take us through the last week in 60 seconds or so?
Well, Stocky, this week the trial's been focused on forensics after Irma Palasik was found dead. The man who ran the job, Clifton Frost, has had to cast his mind back 26 years to remember details about how he managed the scene and collected the evidence. His account also revealed details about the attack on Mrs. Palasik, including her significant injuries. And the defence case has begun to emerge, with Steve Fabrizi's lawyer cross-examining Mr. Frost.
Thank you, Liz. Really looking forward to talking a bit about the defence case, how that's emerged over the last few days, really, actually. In our last episode, though, we heard what it was like the night of the home invasion in 1999. Today, I'm really keen to dive into the aftermath of that, what the police arrived to. Liz, what have we heard about the scene at the house after the home invasion?
Well, we've already discussed what a mess it was. This week, Clifton Frost told us about how every drawer, every cupboard, everything had been emptied. There were hundreds of items throughout the house. They'd even emptied the freezer, and they had to deal with that material fairly quickly. They had to check if there were fingerprints, obviously, on the plastic around, say, for instance, the frozen meat. So they had to sort of take away that wrapping and then deal with the stuff inside, I guess. But there were all sorts of challenges. But the biggest challenge at the very outset was that Irma Palasik had passed away in the corridor and they had to remove her body from the scene. But before they could do that, because of all the stuff around, they had to get down on their hands and knees and crawl along the floor, picking up any evidence to clear a space. And they were looking for hairs and fibres and that sort of thing. But it was to clear a space so that the undertakers could safely come in without contaminating the scene. So it was quite meticulous when they first even went into this scene.
Yeah, I can, you know, the way you've described that, you know, for someone to get in and recover Irma Palasik's body, Irma's been killed during that home invasion, it just says so much about how much work needs to be done at a scene like this. I mean, the thing I found interesting in going through some of the notes that, you know, you've both been compiling for this is, you know, the level of detail that people were going into in their evidence. You know, the paramedic going in, talking about how, you know, the places he checked Omoplastix for a pulse when he was allowed into the house. The only one of the paramedics allowed him because they didn't want the scene kind of contaminated by anyone who didn't need to be there. And again, that movement by the undertaker being really carefully kind of controlled and managed. What have we heard so far about the injuries that Irma sustained, Liz?
Well, you know, I don't get confronted by much these days, but the most confronting bit so far that we've heard actually came from this evidence, which I sort of wasn't expecting. So Mr. Frost talked about how in the lounge room they'd found mostly it was Gregor Palasik's blood on the floor, and that they were able to determine, even from what they examined there, that for some period he'd been quite still, which gels with his belief that he had passed out for a while. And then they went into the hallway, and there was a lot of blood, of course, from Irma Palasik, from her injuries there, but particularly in the doorway of the bathroom. And the evidence was that they had been able to determine from the splatter of the blood and how much blood was there, that that was the place where she sustained most of her injuries. And included in that was information about, for instance, she had dentures and her dentures were found on the carpet. I just thought that the whole description of that really conveyed the violence that had gone on in this house during the home invasion.
Yeah, it sounds so confronting and so violent, Liz. You know, as you say, you know, that the story that her dentures tell, not being with her, still being in this scene, just kind of really conveys that. James, what did we hear about the injuries that Irma sustained?
Clifton Frost spoke through his cataloguing of the autopsy that was something that he observed, not carried out. That was someone else's job, and we haven't heard that witness yet. But it was described at great length, and there was a lot to describe to the jury, the injuries that Irma had sustained. If you imagine a basic outline of a human body, genderless, no face, no hair, that has been drawn on a page, sort of a generic thing, a very simple outline of a human body, then off of that, different lines corresponding to the place where an injury had been recorded. And Trent Hickey, the lead prosecutor, took Clifton Frost through every single one of those records. Pictures were being shown to the jury of each injury on Irma's body that had been taken as part of the autopsy. It was quite clear that some of them found that quite confronting, as you might expect. Each injury had a small evidence sticker that had a number. Clifton Frost was taken through that sticker, that number, that body part, that injury in extreme detail, and he said, we'll start clockwise at the top of the head and we'll work all the way around the body. There was a break in the middle, but I calculated roughly about 30 minutes in total that it took just to list each one of those injuries. The worst of them were on her face and around her head, and some also to her abdomen. I mean, we won't go into the detail because it's pretty gruesome, but suffice to say that her injuries were significant, as Liz was saying.
Yeah. And Liz, are we going to get a bit more detail on the cause of Irma's death from someone who's done the autopsy or something at some stage?
Yes, we will. The original pathologist who carried out the autopsy has since died, but there is another person who has done a report about this from the original investigation, and we do expect to hear from him. That was all foreshadowed in the openings.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Liz. I mean, I spoke at the top of the episode about the length of the investigation, how hard and how much work was done, just kind of pulling apart and looking for any clue, any indication of who might have been behind this home invasion and this violent attack on Irma Palasik and her husband Gregor in 1999. James, how long did it take police to go through this house, to comb through their property in McKellar in Canberra?
Well, all in all, we heard that the crime scene examination took 8 days. And you can imagine the state of the house, this ransacked state of the house. Every item potentially has evidence on it. It might be the tiniest drop of blood. It might be half a fingerprint, it might be half a footprint here and there. We learned such a lot about lots of different techniques that we used at the time, and we'll get into those. We learned a lot about anti-contamination measures. Near enough at every juncture, Clifton Frost was asked, and then what did you do for anti-contamination? And then what did you do? And then what did you do? We learned there were a lot of changing of gloves. There was a lot of putting on and off of booties and of bodysuits. And he described that periodically, really every few minutes, he was asked that, which indicates, you know, the degree to which they're trying to keep the evidence as pristine as perhaps the attempts were made to keep the forensics and the crime scene at the time. Stocky, there's a reason that expression in forensic detail is an expression because there is so much detail. If you in our everyday lives, we probably don't really focus in that much detail in the way that, you know, these people are trained to do. It really was fascinating. I mean, Clifton Frost hasn't actually finished giving his evidence. He was speaking in court for several days and still has a little to go. There were a few red herrings along the way. There was a sort of a reddish, purplish patch on the floor in one section in the dining room. That turned out to be Ribena. We've talked about the frozen meat. Obviously, that could potentially give false negatives given its contents. There was the fly screen, which was where the defendants are alleged to have entered the house. And they even took that out. They fingerprinted that. They talked about how it had been, the marks on the metal frame of the fly screen had been consistent with a flat object a jimmy had opened. A jimmy bar was talked about in court. They even analysed the mesh. Was it torn? Was it cut? Again, we're changing gloves. A lot of pictures of the crime scene were shown to the jury in various levels of detail, you know, sort of wide shots of the mess, very detailed shots of blood spots. At some points, you know, we're going through each individual spot of blood. We're talking about directions of travel and so on. We talked just before about that clearing the path and that hands and knees search. It was interesting. Mr. Frost talked about we search in layers. You know, first we do a visual search, and then, you know, we pick all of those things up. Then we might do tape lifts. So that is sticking basically special type of tape and then lifting up. It might be fibers. It might be hair. It might be dust. They then vacuum that area, and then they keep the contents of that vacuum bag. That goes into evidence. And again, we change gloves when we go in the house. When each time they collect an exhibit, this, they must have gone through, I mean, thousands of pairs of gloves. This was talked about ad nauseum, really. One other interesting, perhaps less forensic detail, but it certainly was interesting nonetheless, Clifton Frost talked about the outside sensor lights having been unscrewed slightly, so to the point he talked about a quarter turn, enough for them to stop working. Now, people might remember from the last episode, Gregor talked about how the lights were earlier in the evening going on and off, and then he talked about in that quite confronting bedside interview with police just in the hours after the incident how the sensor lights out the back for some reason weren't working, and so that was an interesting detail. One particularly interesting technique, which I hadn't heard of before, unsurprisingly, was something called an electrostatic lift, Stocky, and this is where you put down a piece of special paper, special sort of material. On one side, it sort of has a sticky gel, and on the other side, it has essentially like alfoil. And you put a charge through it, and what happens is that charge lifts some of the particles of a footprint, and you can then go away, and what you have is a negative version of that, and you can go and sort of check that against various other bits of evidence, or to, you know, rule out whether it's a police footprint or perhaps an offender. So we really did, as I say, in forensic detail, go through near enough every moment, in fact, every moment, really, that the prosecution thought was significant in terms of this case.
Just a huge amount of detail that we're kind of unpacking through this. And I mean, it sounded like a lot of the disturbance was in the kitchen. You know, we've talked about the secret compartment that was built underneath the oven, I think, which is where the Palasics were storing cash. Liz, am I right in thinking that's where kind of a lot of this detritus and investigation was focused?
Yes, and on the fridge as well. So Mr. Frost has dealt with up to collecting the information. So we haven't gone into any DNA evidence or anything yet, but those were, they had to swab anything you could drink out of in the fridge.
Mm-hmm.
And so that he described in detail how they went about that. There was the Reebok shoe print in the in the kitchen, which James was very taken with, because to identify it as a Reebok shoe, they had to send it to the shoe library, the image at least, to the shoe library in Melbourne to work out what type of shoe it actually was. And it turned out that that was not, that did not belong to anyone else who'd been in the scene. So it was a clue at the time.
Mm.
So there was a lot of focus on the kitchen. It was a very difficult area to process as well, because it was in such disarray.
Mm.
But interestingly, no fingerprints anywhere that they could pick up on.
Right. And I mean, you know, the shoe print is a fascinating detail. I think, you know, it being a Reebok shoe as well really helps place us in 1999, when that would have been that was a popular brand. Certainly the shoe that I was coveting while I was at school. James, the shoe library, I need to know a little bit more about this though. Can you talk us through what's going on here?
It was touched on briefly, and Liz is right. I was like, oh, shoe library, that's so interesting. Clifton Frost talked about there being this library of, really, I suppose it's shoe print library, or footprint library, however you want to describe it, apparently at the time, and it'd be interesting to know if it still exists, but apparently at the time there was this in Melbourne, this shoe library of presumably mainstream, popular, highly manufactured shoe prints. They were able to use that electrostatic lift method that I just described. Clifton explained it. Mr. Frost explained it well in course. But yes, once they had it, it was only a partial print, but once they had it, they were able to then match it to this library in Melbourne. And as you say, Reebok was what it came back with.
Yeah. Liz, I mean, this is what we've got you here for. Are we still working with shoe libraries and the like around the country?
Oh, we probably are. If it can be catalogued, forensic scientists have done it.
that's their whole job, I imagine, is cataloguing things, matching things, looking for stuff. So yeah, I love the way you've kind of described all of this and taken us into this scene. I mean, James, you know, you're talking about the level of detail, what is being collected. How is this information being presented to the jury? I'm imagining that these photos are up on a screen and there's like a little card or something next to it, like a little measure or something to indicate that it's been catalogued. Is that what we're getting here? Is that what's being shown to the jury?
It's a bit hard to know, because all of these forensic photos, you really only catch glimpses of, whilst they haven't been restricted per se. Some have a non-publication order on them, and obviously, therefore, that means we can never publish them.
Right.
And they're some of the more gruesome ones of Irma, and the judge has made that order quite early on.
Mm.
But you do see, you know, where we sit at the back of the court, you're behind the bar table, and obviously the lawyers are following along, and so you sort of do catch glimpses. And some of it is quite perfunctory. You know, it might be something that's almost really indiscernible, like a perhaps a red dot on a wooden background. Almost, you can barely see it. They usually will have a small sticker that has a number, and that corresponds it to sort of the database of evidence that's been collected and so on.
Mm.
We learned a lot about cotton swabs, how they're packaged, how you get them out of the packaging, how you change your gloves each time if you're a forensic officer. So the jury was very much they were brought up to speed in 1999 forensic cotton swab analysis best practice.
Yep.
That was mainly around the swabs that were taken around the lip of the water jug and the opening of the milk container. Now, people might remember from previous episodes, this is crucial. These two pieces of evidence and these two otherwise quite ordinary everyday items are crucial to the case, because these swabs were where the DNA samples were detected, as we've been talking about. Gregor talks about whoever was in the house that night drinking from those two containers, and that's why they were swabbed. And so we talked about the lip of the jug, we talked about the handle of the jug, we talked about how far down the lip was swabbed, and so on and so forth. There was also a scotch bottle that was in the door of the fridge, which that was talked about, but it really was those two items: the milk container, which is alleged to have Fabrizi's DNA on it, and the water jug, which is alleged to have Vicconi's DNA on it.
Yeah, and those, as you say, James, two items really core to the prosecution case against Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Vicconi. Talking about Clifton Frost and his evidence, you know, he's basically been the witness that we've had since our last episode. And he has gone through his evidence in chief, which is where he's questioned by the prosecution. And they talk through all of this stuff in that, as we talked about, kind of forensic detail. And then we get to the cross-examination. This is the defense's opportunity to start to work in there and, you know, asking questions that they're, you know, looking to kind of challenge the prosecution case. And it sounds like Sky Jerome, who's Steve Fabrizi's lawyer, really kind of got to work on Clifton Frost, Liz.
Yes. Well, a lot of the questions that were raised by the prosecutor were also raised by her in sort of similar context. How many times did you change your booties? Did you change them on the way out or the way in? Same, James's may have appeared to have talked endlessly about gloves, but this is a true reflection of the cross-examination and the original examination. So she went into all that detail. There's a few little bits and pieces. We don't know if they're red herrings or not. Mm. But the thing that she really got to was the grey square. Now, a grey square is what you used to use when people took real pictures with film so that you could, I don't know if they still use it, but basically what it does is help you when you're developing. So you put the grey square beside what you're photographing. And when you're developing the film, the colours in the image are truer to what they were. So with this crime scene, like just like CSI, lots of photos were taken.
Mm.
Now, Sky Jerome has pointed out several of these photos, and it wasn't what was in the photo other than the grey square, but where the photos were taken. Mm-hmm. So there was one was taken on top of a camera case. There was another one taken on the pavers, appeared to be taken on the pavers outside the house, because they had to do a lot of their work out there because the house was in such a mess.
Mm.
And so to keep things clean.
Yeah.
Then there was another place where the grey square was on the floor beside a blood stain. And her question was, did you clean off that grey square, which was in a plastic sleeve, before each photo was taken? And the answer to that was probably not. And Clifton Frost admitted that that probably wasn't best practice. So Ms. Jerome then asked him, is that because you can get biological transfer? And he agreed that that was probably the case. And then she asked the DNA question. And he said there was potential for DNA to be transferred in that fashion.
Right. I mean, are we starting to get an idea of the defence case through Ms. Jerome's questioning to Clifton Frost?
Yes. And remember, Steve Fabrizi has admitted being there, but he says he was outside pretty much for most of the time, being the lookout, that he only went in to help Mr. Facconi get out the window. And this is a way that she's trying to show, I guess, to the jury that there is a possibility of DNA transfer, that his presence of DNA in parts of the house that, you know, where the prosecution's alleged he was in there, might not stand up if these practices weren't done properly. I mean, what else was done that might have transferred DNA?
Yeah. No, it's, you know, as we've talked about a number of times in this series, DNA so crucial to the prosecution case. So Sky Jerome, yeah, looking at this, asking those kind of questions will be really interesting to see how that line of question, I suppose, continues through Clifton Frost as his cross-examination continues, and then other witnesses, certainly once we start to get into some of the DNA evidence over the next week or so. Since our last episode on Thursday last week, there have been a number of delays in court in Canberra, in the Canberra Supreme Court. This hasn't been sitting every single day. Liz, what's going on?
Well, I can't really tell you. And that's because this is a jury trial. I can only tell you what the jury's been told.
Mm-hmm.
And each day they've been told. Sometimes they've been held back for a little while in the hope that things may change, but they haven't. And we've lost probably three full days now while the court is dealing with matters, and the jury's just been told that they wouldn't be required for the rest of the day.
Yep.
So maybe we'll be able to enlighten you about that a bit later. But the point here is this is not unusual. This does happen in trials.
Yeah, absolutely. Often delays, often a number of different reasons that, you know, court might not sit on a certain day. So don't read too deeply into it. We are taking notes of all the reasons, of course, aren't we? You know, there's some things we can, you know, keep track of. And all of those things will be in the episodes that we put together at the end of the trial. So we can give you a full insight into all the things that happened that the jury didn't know about during the process. It's like a little secret dossier that we keep out to the side. I mean, James, how's Justice Mossop through these delays? I mean, I imagine he's probably pretty keen to keep things moving.
Well, certainly that is the case. I mean, that is the case with any trial, of course. Again, we have to sort of colour within the lines here because we can only really talk about what the jury has heard. He has developed a bit of a catchphrase with the jury because they have come in and out so much, which is, don't get too comfortable. And then they all sort of look at each other and go, okay, right, well, something's happening. But to the extent that he is able, he's trying to sort of keep the buses running on time and keep things moving along.
Yeah, absolutely. We are getting plenty of questions through to the case of mailbag. It is starting to swell as people discover the case of the two intruders and their curiosity is piqued. And I'd love to run through a few of them now. These are emails that have been sent to the case of at abc.net.au. Jane has written in. Jane's actually sent us three questions. Two of them we can't answer during the trial, so I'm not even going to throw them out there, but we have filed away for our post-trial episodes. One I think we can, though, Liz. Jane's question is, do police think that the two accused committed the earlier robberies? We've talked about three robberies on the Plasix home, one in 1997, one in 1998, and one in 1999, which resulted in the death of Irma Plasix. Jane's question, do the police think that Joseph Ficconi and Steve Fabrizi were involved in all of them?
Well, the answer to that is no. No one knows who was responsible for the 1997 robbery. In 1998, there is an allegation that Mr. Ficconi was, and he's actually been charged over it, that he was involved, and that's due to some DNA evidence on a balaclava, which has since been lost, but we've talked about that before.
Yep.
His lawyers signalled he will be fighting that.
Yep.
And it's only in 1999 that Steve Fabrizi came into the picture. So there's two robberies that it's alleged Joseph Ficconi was involved in, but only one involving Steve Fabrizi.
Got it.
And a reminder, Jane, that because it is confusing, the through line there with the DNA is that at later stages when those DNA samples were tested, so the tape left from the balaclava that was left at the 98 incident, it's alleged that that DNA was Ficconi's and that DNA profile matched also the water jug DNA sample from 1999. So that is how the prosecution is putting Ficconi at those two incidents.
Gotcha. Great. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, James. And thank you, Jane, for that wonderful question. Another one here from Francesca, listening from Hawthorne in Melbourne. She has been listening intently to the DNA evidence and has been wondering about when it's alleged a DNA sample is 1 billion times more likely to have come from person X than from someone else. Who exactly is this someone else they are comparing X to?
Well, I want to meet this person X. We've got a lot in common, been in a lot of trials together. But in this case, the allegation from the prosecution is that the samples taken were 100 billion times more likely to be from these two men than anyone else.
Right.
Now, that is being contested by both sides. And I think we will learn more about that as the trial continues. I suspect there may be some people called to talk about that because the defence lawyers have already signalled that they will be challenging whether that is the case, whether that's the right way to express a DNA result.
Got it. And when you say, because, you know, say anyone else, it's just basically any other person, right, is the likelihood or the statistics they're working with?
Yes. Yes, that's right. But we'll just have to see how this unfolds.
Mm.
I think this is one of the trickiest parts of the trial.
Yep. Okay. Wonderful question, Francesca. Liz, thank you for answering that and clarifying that. And Francesca, I'm going to put this one in the maybe we'll come back to it pile as well, because I expect this is a conversation we will be having again on the case of the two intruders. If you have any questions, please email thecaseof@abc.net.au. We do love hearing from you. Very interested in all of your thoughts, feelings, reflections, specifically questions, but we do welcome and take all comers. Liz, where are we going next in the trial?
Well, there's more cross-examination coming. So Sky Jerome hasn't finished her cross-examination yet. And Mr. Facconi's lawyer, Travis Jackson, has to have his turn too. So that's what will be coming in the next little while.
Wonderful. We'll be back in your feed on Tuesday next week. And if you're looking for something to listen to in the meantime, ABC Listen always has your back. And I've been getting around the latest season of Expanse, which published on Tuesday this week. They're going to be dropping episodes each week. This one's The Nanup Four. It's a story about a family of four people who went missing in 2007. It's this kind of baffling story of control and secret identities and a dark online cult. I've been listening to the first episode, and it is incredibly creepy, but also fascinating. So I would recommend getting yourself around that, sorting yourself out with ABC Listen. Best place to listen to The Case Of. It's where our episodes rock up before they appear anywhere else. And if you are using a different podcast platform, please give us a rating and a review so more people can learn about the story of the two intruders. The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Elizabeth Byrne and James Viver and is presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to the ABC lawyers for their wonderful advice as we make these episodes, to the ACT ABC Newsroom and to Audio Studios manager Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri, Gadigal and Wurundjeri people.